The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Buried in debt and facing the frightening reality that I was now a single parent. As a Black woman mothering alone, I was now in the minority one-parent household statistic, and terrified that I'd make mistakes in parenting that would lead to my beautiful, innocent baby girl becoming a statistic too. I felt the weight of the world on my shoulders. In front of others, I put on a facade of confidence and surety, but I was stressed out, losing weight, and feeling hopeless and alone. I even tried to fool myself into thinking I had everything under control at times, but one day, when Tori was 6 months old, I became present enough to notice her looking up at me with those big, beautiful eyes. In that moment, I was reminded of just how dependent on me she was and just how broken I was. I no longer wanted to pretend that everything was okay. I prayed desperately, "Dear God, if you get me out of this debt and pit of despair, I promise I'll never get into it again." I also promised Tori that she would enjoy a life as full as any child with two involved parents, and that I would be someone she could look up to as her shero. For me, this meant going back to school at night and on weekends in pursuit of my master's and doctorate degrees, which I did while working a full-time job in human resources. I also committed to getting counseling and figuring out how to become debt-free. As Tori grew bigger and stronger, so did my desire to be the protection and example she needed in life. She started to experience things that I would have given anything to shelter her from. In kindergarten, unspeakably hateful words were spoken to her because of the color of her skin. She started to see the jagged edges of the world and began asking heart-wrenching questions about race that no child should be forced to ask. Simultaneously, I was facing my own battles with racism and prejudice at my job. The more my career in HR progressed, the more I began to experience inequities as a woman, a person of color, and a single mom. I was overlooked for promotions, had insensitive comments directed at me, and was made to feel invisible. I would sit in meetings and come up with sound ideas to implement that were ignored, yet 20 minutes later, a white male colleague would utter the same words and be applauded. I'd been told many times that I wasn't qualified enough, yet asked to train people, even my new bosses. There came a point in my career when I entered into diversity and inclusion, but quickly felt like I was the token Black. An interaction with a former employer all but confirmed this, and it was a crushing setback to my career. I was making so many sacrifices to be able to provide for Tori, and had spent more than 7 years obtaining my degrees and multiple certifications to take away the excuses of why I wasn't worthy. I lost my sense of self and was miserable. Weeks later, when the hurt and devastation subsided, I got mad and purposeful. Even though I thought I wanted to be done with DE&I, I felt in my soul that if something didn't change, my daughter would experience the same type of prejudice and racism when she entered the workforce. Although traumatic, this experience fueled my resolve, and I forged ahead with my inclusivity work at a different company. After an intentional conversation about my career with Tori, who was now 14 years old, her passion for diversity and inclusion began. In the 2 years that followed, she became the first African American in Montgomery County, Maryland, to be a title holder in the Miss America teen pageant, with a platform of eliminating hate, bias, and prejudice in our society. This led to her being selected as an ambassador for the National Youth Leadership Conference, hosted by the Anti-Defamation League, and working with Invisible Children, an organization that partners with local peace builders across Central Africa. Her role was to educate people about the atrocities that children in Africa were enduring, and she was part of a team of youth ambassadors that raised over $10,000 to contribute to that cause. My daughter was following in my footsteps and picking up on the example I set out to be for her when she was a baby. I could not have been more proud. It's been 30 years now, and I'm still loving HR and DE&I work. The darkest moment of my career was ultimately one of my greatest lessons. I am now coaching thousands on how to step over racism and biases to realize their dreams, and I run a global consulting firm that helps organizations transform their work cultures. Last year, I was asked by Wiley Publishing to write the first ever Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion for Dummies book, available on Amazon. I've kept my promise to God and to my daughter. Our purpose is now fully aligned, and last year, Tori made the decision to become part of my firm, working alongside me to help organizations build cultures of inclusion, equity, and belonging. It gives me no greater pleasure than to leave a legacy for my daughter, and together we are making life better for those coming behind us. Our next article by Deesha Dyer is titled, Heading to the Altar at 44, Having Finally Found Self-Love. After a drink at a hotel bar during a little road trip in Virginia a few months ago, I wrote a tweet about my upcoming wedding. My fiancé, Wes, had just gone to our room to grab my jacket so I wouldn't be cold on our walk to dinner. I don't typically drink much, so after my cocktail, I was feeling sentimental, giddy, and lucky in love. The tweet read, I'm very excited to get married this year at age 44. There's a maturity and clarity that I would have never been able to access in my 20s or 30s to be a healthy partner. I will never say I waited for him all my life. I was waiting for me. I'm no stranger to social media, and I had recently received a flood of responses when I shared the announcement of my engagement. Even so, I never imagined that in a matter of 2 days, over 80,000 people would find a home in my words about waiting. While there was a flurry of encouraging comments, sweet stories, comical advice, and replies from those respectfully stating that marriage isn't for them, there were also critics. Some people implied that something was wrong with me and accused me of being cruel to my unborn children by waiting until 44 to be a potential parent, even though we decided long ago to not have kids. But the messages from neither my supporters nor my detractors struck me as much as the selection of vulnerable revelations from those wishing to be in a healthy, intimate partnership. I could feel and hear the disappointment while reading words like, "Lucky you, this will never happen for me," or "I'm sick of waiting, so I gave up." I worried that my tweet was contributing to the toxic thinking that marriage is a prize that one must obtain for happiness and love, the very fantasy I'd finally relinquished. I grew up a child of divorced parents and sought refuge, escape, and entertainment through TV. I'd watch soap operas and sitcoms, which gave a romanticized view of love. Everything would be resolved in 30 to 60 minutes, and the couple would be all smiles by the time the credits rolled. Thanks to my mother and the elder aunties who watched me after school, my main jam became General Hospital. As I grew older and started to be interested in boys, I applied that microwave philosophy in my relationships and was continually disappointed in the realization that it would take a lot longer than 30 minutes to resolve the problems of a real-life intimate partnership. Like many people who are single or searching, I was looking for a relationship to show me I was worthy of being loved. I was sure that someone choosing me would make me feel good about the woman I looked at in the mirror every day. Plagued by a lack of self-worth that no amount of accolades or validation would solve, I realize now that I helped destroy my relationships to confirm my worst fears about myself. I built a successful career, climbing to the top ranks of the White House, and was at a place where I felt confident in what I achieved. Still, at 39, I was riddled with personal insecurities. After 8 years with President and Mrs. Obama in D.C., my world was rocked by a horrible breakup with someone I met in my last year of the administration. This was someone with whom I planned to make a life and live happily ever after. His departure brought me to my knees, literally and figuratively. Looking back, I feel silly writing that, not because of my passionate reaction, but because he so clearly wasn't worthy of it. Turning 40 was a changing point for me. I sought out therapy with commitment and intention. It wasn't just the actual breakup. The split brought up those feelings that were buried but not dead. Feelings of insecurity, shame, and guilt. I wasn't a stranger to therapy, but this is the first time I took it seriously, because I was ready to boldly face everything, no matter how painful. I also dove deeper into my faith, which forced me to focus on my relationship with God, another relationship that needed some work. I was disappointed in God. I didn't think I was one of God's chosen ones despite what scriptures told me. Why would God let me feel so low even though I was praying and following all the rules? One day in my apartment in Brooklyn, I Googled churches and walked into one that weekend. Not only did the sermon focus on mental health, but the church had counselors available for free for anyone who needed them. Soon I turned my faith inward to focus on my strengths. My prayers began to fill with words of gratitude for my body, my soul, and my spirit. They became less focused on external requests, which allowed me to see myself as deserving of healthy love in all its forms. I started to reclaim the parts of me that were existing for someone else, like a partner or something else, like a star-studded career. Could I still enjoy my own body if it wasn't attracting a partner? Could I value my own ideas if they weren't bringing me acclaim or promotions? I had to sit in discomfort and break up with the ways in which I thought love was supposed to feel and go. This was done by building a foundation of love for myself, not someone else. Trust me, I recognize that this sounds a bit corny, idealistic, and unrealistic, but I let go of feeling corny. I said yes to being idealistic. I met Wes in the summer of 2019, exactly 15 months after committing to a therapy office, a church, and a gym. Like so many other New York singles, I was working by day and swiping by night. When I matched with Wes, it was the first time in my life I was looking just for companionship without expectation. Wes and I had a slow but fun start. I was working at the Ford Foundation, and it was the first night of the Ford Gallery opening. He let me know how much he loved doing things around the city and being in the nonprofit realm, so I knew he'd appreciate visiting the mecca of traditional philanthropy. We quickly realized we were perfectly opposite, but in all the best ways that kept us laughing all night. On that first date, Wes told me the story of his divorce, and I told him about my recent journey of self-discovery, not skipping or sugarcoating any details. We'd broken all the dating rules about oversharing, but it turns out we were both okay with that. It wasn't all butterflies, however, and still isn't. Now I know that all relationships are work. We stumble, we disagree, and we do our best to work through everything by talking about hard things like politics, race, privilege, and finances. We also do our best to work through the annoying things, like when I would rather leave clean laundry on the bed instead of folding it, or when he subjects me to fish concerts during a long road trip. As we head toward our wedding day this month, I know this relationship is different because I'm different. I'm still learning and I'm still growing. This is a lifelong process. I continue to do the self-work too. I recognize that doubt is normal and dare to meet my fears and his, and this keeps us balanced as we walk the tightrope of growth. I'm allowing myself to feel joy and be in the clouds while also keeping both feet on the ground. My heart, health, and soul are the priority. It took me over 40 years to become a version of myself that welcomed the real work it takes to reap abundance and joy instead of the one looking for a fairy tale. I've never been a timeline or rule follower in life, so I'm pretty much on brand here. The wedding in September is a celebration with our community and a public declaration of our love and commitment to one another. Every single day I look at Wes and I'm so excited to share my life with someone who is getting the absolute best version of me, and that was worth the wait. Our next article by Catherine Watson is titled, The Truth About Gentle Parenting. There comes a moment in every parent's life when they realize that they need a strategy. Maybe that moment comes in the middle of the grocery store checkout line when your three-year-old has a full meltdown after being denied their favorite candy at the cash register. You wonder what you're doing wrong and if it's too late to fix it. Perhaps it happens at the beach when you're screaming into the wind and sand for your child to stay close to you. They seem content to scurry away, pretending that they have never seen you before. You wonder how you can keep them safe when they aren't even listening to you. It could even be a moment that happens in your therapist's office, when it dawns on you that you'll do anything to raise your children in a safer, calmer, happier home than the one you grew up in. More and more parents looking for a strategy that combines healthy boundaries, natural consequences, and respect for others are turning to a philosophy called gentle parenting. As the name suggests, gentle parenting is meant to give children lots of compassionate cushion as parents lead them through empathy. That all sounds wonderful in theory, but does gentle parenting actually work? We asked a parenting expert for the pros and cons of this approach. What is gentle parenting? Gentle parenting is a form of positive parenting that emphasizes understanding a child's behavior through empathy and respect, giving choices versus commands, and responding in a way that considers a child's intellectual and developmental levels, explains Dan Peters, PhD, a psychologist and host of the Parent Footprint podcast. The way gentle parenting looks on a practical level will vary from family to family, But the central tenets of empathy, respect, understanding, and healthy boundaries should inform the way that all gentle parents make decisions. The goals of gentle parenting are to raise children who understand and can regulate their emotions, respect and have empathy for themselves and others, and have healthy and collaborative relationships, says Peters. Where did gentle parenting come from? A British author named Sarah Ockwell Smith is generally regarded as the founder of the gentle parenting movement. She has written 13 parenting books centered around the gentle philosophy. Ockwell Smith isn't a pediatrician or a neuroscientist. She is, however, a parent of 4 children of her own. Gentle parenting has become quite popular on social media. Hashtag gentle parenting has 2.8 billion views on TikTok, as parenting experts and everyday parents offer tips, tricks, and examples of how gentle parenting can work in real life. How does gentle parenting work in the real world? Gentle parenting is supposed to be a strategy that you can use throughout your time as a parent. Starting when your children are young is the easiest way to set boundaries and establish the expectation of natural consequences. Real-world examples of gentle parenting will look different at different phases of your child's development. Peter gives some examples. If your toddler spills their milk, the gentle parenting response won't be to scold their carelessness or respond with words of frustration. Instead, your child could be required to help clean up their mess with your assistance. That helps your child understand natural consequences and also that they bear responsibility for their actions. If a kindergarten-age child doesn't want to go to school and expresses their emotions with yelling and crying, the gentle parenting response would not be to dismiss their reaction. Instead, you would comment on your child's reaction and validate them. The goal would be to communicate understanding in an effort to help your child regulate their emotions, calm down, and get ready for school. If a teenage child comes home past their curfew, the gentle parenting response would not be to seek out a punitive consequence. That is not to say that there would be no punishment. The parent would explain the importance of honoring the curfew agreement and communicate a natural consequence, such as taking a night off from going out, having an earlier curfew to allow for more cushion for being late, or a plan for reminders to be home on time. The consequence would be based on finding the cause of the behavior and addressing it accordingly. What are the pros and cons of gentle parenting? When the philosophy is implemented consistently, gentle parenting has great promise as a parenting strategy. Proponents of gentle parenting believe that the strategy offers opportunities to address children as individuals and to foster empathy and respect. Gentle parenting does have some potential pitfalls, especially if the strategy is not applied consistently. Gentle parenting also can't be used as an excuse for non-confrontational parents to avoid setting any rules or boundaries with your child. The technique isn't to never discipline your child at all. The idea is to discipline them differently. In other words, the strategy works only if it is establishing healthy, predictable family rhythms that both you and your child feel comfortable with. There's the potential for parents to be too permissive and not set appropriate boundaries and expectations for behavior. Additional potential problems include indulging a child's emotions and behavior without guiding and teaching, says Peters. Is there any research to support gentle parenting? Gentle parenting is a fairly new approach to parenting. It's also hard to objectively quantify how many people are doing it and how they are applying the philosophy. That means that there isn't a lot of clinical research diving into how gentle parenting affects children as they grow into adults. The principles behind gentle parenting have a lot in common with what's known as authoritative and positive parenting, says Peters. Positive communication, collaborative relationships, empathy, and respect result in adults who feel confident, communicate effectively, have emotional awareness, and have positive social skills and relationships, he says. Research indicates that authoritative parenting leads to children with healthy self-esteem who can self-regulate their emotions. It also means they understand disciplinary methods as a way of support instead of as a punishment. Should you try gentle parenting? Adults who have empathy and care for other people are a gift to the whole world. Gentle parenting is a way you can start to instill those values in your children. It also fosters independence, self-confidence, and values. Gentle parenting isn't a way to avoid disciplining your child altogether. It's also not a magical way to make everyone get along. It takes a lot of intention, patience, and inner work to apply the philosophies of gentle parenting to your everyday choices with your kids. Our next article by Deanna Janes is titled 12 Friendship Apps That'll Help You Meet New People. It used to be that making new pals was as easy as recess in the schoolyard. Adulthood, however, poses its own obstacles to finding your ride or die, the least of which are crammed schedules, parental duties, and not wanting to leave your comfort zone, especially if you're an introvert. If you've moved to a new town or city, making connections with others in your new locale is an important part of helping you settle down and thrive in your new life. Many of us forge lasting friendships through our jobs, but with so many companies offering full-time work from home options, this is another strong buddy-building avenue at risk. These platonic relationships can be so vital. Just as dating apps have helped to solve the dilemma of finding love in the digital age, apps to make friends are working to fill another void. Options abound, so read on for the best friendship apps that can both help you expand your network and find the Gale to your Oprah, or vice versa. Bonus, most of them are free. Number 1, Meetup. A simple way to join a like-minded social circle, Meetup matches people based on their shared interests. Read female programmers, bar hoppers, and even nature photographers. Themes range from general, free comedy and new friends NYC, to niche, Southern California Bulldog Crew. And you can search by demographic so you don't land at a happy hour with a bunch of 20-somethings. Unless you want to. Cost, free. Number 2, Yubo. If you like to take your time getting to know new people before jumping into a friendship, Yubo might be for you. Yubo is a social live streaming platform that lets you swipe to find new friends, chat with them in the app, hang out in shared live streams, and explore different interest groups. Cost, free. Number 3, Peanut. Your kids' calendars are packed with playdates and social gatherings, but moms need friends too. Enter Peanut, an app created with mamas in mind. An easy way to meet mom friends, seek parenting advice, and join momversations, the app suggests women with similar age children in your neighborhood with the new, nearly universal swiping method. But that's not all. Peanut also has communities of those who are navigating fertility and menopause, with the goal to connect women of all ages with like-minded individuals. Cost free. Number 4, Bumble BFF. The female-centric Bumble dating app burst onto the scene in 2014. Since then, the company has launched Bumble BFF mode as a way for women to meet women simply wanting friends. And though the Swipe Happy app is a hit with younger millennials, there are success stories belonging to those born before the early 80s. For professionally minded networking, check out Bumble Biz too. Cost free. Number 5, Wink. Wink is a friendship app that connects users to potential friends both locally and around the world. If you're looking for a resource that is dedicated to serving friendships only, Wink is for you. First, you create a profile featuring a host of personal photos and details on your interests, preferences, likes, and dislikes. From there, you'll be able to explore other users on the app and simply swipe to start a conversation. You can easily send a message, photos, GIFs, and more through the app's messenger feature, too. Cost free. Number 6, LMK. If texting isn't really your thing, give LMK a try. LMK helps you connect with potential friends who share similar interests beyond just sending a quick message. With LMK, you can share voice messages and join talk-based audio room conversations with multiple people. With LMK, you can also even watch YouTube videos together as a shared experience. Cost free. Premium plans start at $4.99 per month for a 6-month subscription. Number 7, Ablo. Ablo is great for anyone looking to cast a wide net with their friendship search. You can meet and chat with people around the world and tune into live stream shows alongside new friends. Additionally, Ablo automatically translates text conversations to a shared language, making it easy to communicate without language barriers. Cost free. Number 8, Hey Vina. Created to empower women through female friendship, Hey Vina is touted as Tinder for girlfriends. But the tenderness begins with the user interface and ends with the algorithm. That's a tech fancy way of saying that just like the dating app, you swipe left and right on possible friends based on proximity, mutual friends, and quiz data. Once you match, the app suggests a spot to meet, like a hiking trail or a wine bar. It's all about building a community of trusted new friends. Cost-free, VIP subscriptions start at $6 a week. Number 9, Nextdoor. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, but do you even know your neighbors? A private social networking app, Nextdoor is your window to everything happening in your neighborhood, be it block events, furniture swaps, community events, or even car break-ins. Beyond being just a news source, though, the app encourages in-person meetings leading to new friendships. Cost free. Number 10, Friender. Whether you're looking for a workout buddy or a purely platonic pal to paint the town with, Friender just might be the way you meet your future partner in fun things. After an introductory survey that has you choose the activities you're interested in, the app suggests people, men are included on this one, who match with at least one of your favorite activities. Cost-free, premium subscriptions start at $5.99 per month. Number 11, Scout. Hoping to make more friends in your neighborhood or find people who are interested in the same hobbies as you? Founded in 2007, Scout allows you to chat, send photos, and exchange virtual gifts with new friends. You can also join in live broadcasts or create your own. While Scout has a dating option as well, many users are simply looking for new friends. You might just find your new book club group on the app. Cost-free, premium subscriptions start at $9.99 per month. Number 12, Athleto. Engaging in team sports exercises more than just your cardiovascular system. They build your social network, too. Athleto knows this and matches fitness fiends based on their location, skill levels, and workout frequency. Through the app, you can join a pre-existing group, softball team, running club, or host a sport activity of your very own. And who knows, maybe you find the dream workout buddy. Cost free. Our next article by Carmen Casido is titled, What It Took to Finally Stand Up to My Biggest Fear. I was in the emergency room in the spring of 2021 when I decided something had to change. I had driven to the hospital so many times in the past few years that I knew the directions to the emergency room and the intake questions by heart. I don't have a life-threatening condition, as you might imagine. I have a pathological fear of vomiting, also called emetophobia, and over the years I have tried everything to try to prevent it. I have broken out my rosary to pray when I feel the slightest bit nauseous, chugged my Lantor ginger ale like it's beer at a college party, worn nausea relief bands, and taken prescription medications typically given to cancer patients. This trip to the ER was just the latest of many, taken at the onset of queasiness to get powerful antiemetics delivered intravenously. I had spent so much time and energy trying to control my nausea, but that day in the ER, I finally realized the one thing I can control about this anxiety disorder was whether I chose to get help or not. My fear had always seemed too big to tackle, but that was before both of my parents died, one right after the other. Surviving the deaths of my parents was harder than I could have ever fathomed. Still, there I was, alive, but in the emergency room. I finally decided to give cognitive behavioral therapy and hypnotherapy a try. I'd been afraid of being sick for so long. Finally, I was sick of my fear. My pathological fear of vomiting began with a nasty bout of food poisoning when I was in kindergarten. I began throwing up uncontrollably, faster than my maternal grandmother could wash the sweet, sour stench of fresh vomit out of my hair and place me in a new set of clean clothes. In the background, I could hear my parents fighting. My mother worried I was dehydrated or worse, wanted to rush me to the hospital. My father, more concerned about the hospital bill, wanted to keep me home. Meanwhile, I remember feeling a sense of dread and embarrassment, like I was at fault for causing my parents to argue. The emetophobia got worse in my adolescence, leading to a scary diagnosis of anorexia. At 13, I became afraid of food because of a vomiting episode and the onset of non-ulcer dyspepsia. If food could conceivably make me nauseated, it was scary. Every subsequent wave of nausea caused me to restrict my food intake to the point where the only foods I considered safe were baked potatoes, wheat toast with grape jelly, and bananas. My weight plummeted to 60 pounds, and I was hospitalized at an eating disorder facility for nearly a year, most of that time with a nasogastric tube, a tube that passed from my nose to my stomach to help me gain the weight I had dropped. All the while, I avoided conversations with some bulimic patients in the ward, several of whom romanticized their binge and purge episodes. Any mention of the word puke would cause me to run out of group therapy sessions. Though I recovered from my dangerously low weight, for 2 decades after that, I treated the symptoms of my phobia, but not the debilitating fear itself. I got very good at avoidance. Trying to dodge turbulence that might make me queasy, it took me years to fly at all and then longer to graduate to long-distance flights. But the journey my phobia has most limited is the one toward my future. Even though I yearn to get married and have children, I've perhaps subconsciously chosen romantic partners who've been ambivalent about that kind of long-term commitment. If they're not willing to take the next step, it takes some of the pressure off me to worry about morning sickness. When a person has a phobia, what is happening on a neurological level is that the amygdala, the part of the brain responsible for processing emotions and memories associated with fear, is trying to keep us safe. In doing so, it registers phobias as something dangerous. For example, in my case, if my brain sees vomiting as hazardous, then food also becomes dangerous since it can lead to throwing up. Those of us with persistent, debilitating phobias are moved to control the trigger, eating certain foods, eating out. But in doing so, we stay stuck in the fear. Instead, I'm learning that controlling the actual phobia instead is where the power lies and where the fear can ultimately lose its grip on us. For some, a phobia is rooted in a traumatic event. During this past year with my new therapist, Sarah, I realized that trauma is part of my phobia. My fear of being ill commingled with my late father's tendency to be emotionally distant and sometimes physically abusive in the name of discipline. I realized that being sick or otherwise standing out could make me a target for my dad's anger and disappointment. Dad's spankings and diminishing comments led me to associate my vomiting fear to the corporal punishments I experienced. Vomiting wasn't just asking for punishment. It was a punishment within me I could not stop. When phobias are linked to trauma, sufferers will avoid certain people, things, or circumstances if they equate it to something traumatic that happened in their lives, explains Thea Gallagher, a clinical psychologist and assistant professor at NYU Langone Health with 17 years of experience treating phobias. But a phobia is just as likely to persist without trauma as with it. Either way, the amygdala is triggered when we are fearful or perceive a threat, activating our fight or flight response, she adds. I understand this all too well. The thought of retching makes my blood pressure rise, my skin turn clammy, and my heart beats so fast that it feels as though I just ran a 5K. Exposure therapy works to break down a person's resistance to the fear, Gallagher explained. With emetophobia, the core fear might be losing control or embarrassing yourself in front of others, or feeling like you won't be able to breathe. For someone with emetophobia, Gallagher will have the person fake gag in public, if their biggest fear about vomiting is related to embarrassment, for example. She'll also have the person being treated create fake vomit and simulate throwing up. Eventually, the person moves up to using a toothbrush to gag themselves. The key is while the person is undergoing exposure therapy, they cannot engage in any ritual safety behavior, for example, avoiding food trucks or over-medicating on anti-nausea pills. I like to normalize and let people know what you're feeling is very real and painful, Gallagher says. But the more we face something, the easier it gets over time. Exposure therapy is uncomfortable, but it works. She says it can take up to 20 sessions for this form of therapy to achieve results, but the person being treated must actively work at it. For example, they need to keep exposing themselves to their fear. The goal is not for people to be completely unafraid, Gallagher says. The goal is to still have some fear, but to do it anyway. I adopted my dog Jack in September 2021, 6 months after I started treatment. In his first week with me, he started throwing up after eating a brand of food that irritated his stomach. I called my ex crying and begging him to drive a half hour to my house to pick up the mess for me. About a month ago, Jack had another vomiting episode. This time it was much worse. He threw up 4 times in 2 days. Instead of asking my ex-boyfriend to help me, I grabbed a ton of paper towels and cleaning solution and cleaned it up myself. It took me more than an hour each time. I was shaking from fear, but simultaneously fighting my fear and my gag reflex. Ultimately, I did it all on my own. Later, I thought about my progress. Though it may be slow, every small improvement has felt like a miracle. These expert-approved techniques for managing fear means you have nothing to fear, not even fear itself. Rebrand the feeling. Instead of letting fear paralyze you, turn it into adrenaline to motivate you. If you're nervous about taking action, whether it's giving a presentation or meeting a blind date, find somewhere to do a few jumping jacks, suggests sociologist Margie Kerr, author of the book Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. As you're jumping, repeat, "I'm so excited right now," Kerr says. It will help rechannel your feelings. And the more often you do that, the more readily you'll experience nervous tension as excitement, not fear in the future. Find a friend. A social support person, a partner, best friend, even your dog, can really help counteract fear, says Vanessa Lobu, PhD, Associate Professor of Psychology and Director of the Child Study Center at Rutgers University. I participated in a study in which women were shown a symbol that meant that they were going to receive a mild electric shock in a few seconds. The ones who were holding their husband's hand showed a completely dampened down stress response in their brain. When a stranger held their hand, that didn't help. Take fear's advice. Speaking of friends, Barry Moniak, a consultant who focuses on fear in the workplace, suggests you start thinking of the emotion as one of your BFFs, the honest, on top of it one who will tell you there's spinach in your teeth. Ask what the fear is saying, says Moniak. It's often that you don't have an adequate skill set to do what you're trying to, and if you get a little more knowledgeable, you'd have nothing to be afraid of. Identify the fear, taking on a leadership role at work, say, you can develop your skills, reading books or taking classes about managing a team successfully and getting to know the people you'll be leading, enough to gain confidence and get moving. Invite jitters. A long-term approach to becoming less fearful, says Kerr, is to engage with the stress response, but in more enjoyable scenarios, trying different foods, going to new places. She points out, older people especially sometimes restrict activity and narrow their lives out of fear. Encouraging yourself to be adventurous and curious and pushing yourself in terms of entertainment or scholarship or activities is a way to increase your resilience and sense of competency. Both excellent attributes to have the next time you find yourself in a scary situation. In order to deflate worry, be specific. If you're nervous something bad will happen, narrow it down specifically to who, what, when, where, why, says clinical psychologist Ellen Hendrickson, PhD. That way you can either figure out how to face the issue or realize it's not as threatening as you once thought. For example, Hendrickson says, people with social anxiety will often think everybody is going to hate me. But when I ask them to get specific, they realize the concern is actually, oh, Darla and Jolene are going to be judgmental of my outfit. That's very different, and when it's expressed, then we can deal with it. Hope for the best, plan for the worst. When you're anxious about something going wrong, Hendrickson advises asking and answering the question, what if? This might mean, if Sam and I break up, I'll go on a long trip. Or to take a personal example, when I was worried I might get COVID-19 and have to self-quarantine, I decided that if I did, I'd stay in the study. It has a glass door, so I'd be able to see my kids even if I couldn't be in the same room. Whatever the circumstance, having a plan reduces the vague uncertainty that makes worry so stressful. Manage your expectations. One thing that can make you panic is the fear of disappointing yourself. If you're anxious about going to a party because you imagine everyone expects you to be funny and cool and not leave any gaps in conversation, say to yourself, I don't have to perform. I just have to show up and listen and be interested in other people, and that's enough, says Hendrickson. Modifying your own standards away from perfectionism is very important in reducing anxiety. To disarm trauma, look past it. In eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR, a therapeutic treatment that has gained traction in the past 30 years, the therapist has a client describe a past trauma, recalling the images, thoughts, feelings, sensations, and what remains disturbing about it, says Deanny Laliotis, a licensed independent social worker and director of training at the EMDR Institute in Watsonville, California. The client is then guided through a series of eye movements, following the therapist's fingers as they move back and forth, almost as if watching a tennis match, while recalling the trauma. This allows her to notice what comes to mind about that memory, while at the same time maintaining an awareness that it's not happening now, says Laliotis. As she re-experiences the trauma while focusing on the eye movement, the emotional and physical distress and confusion is processed out, and eventually it's over permanently because the way the memory is encoded in the brain has changed. It no longer has an emotional charge with a corresponding body sensation, so the recalled experience and other memories like it are effectively neutralized. The past is in the past rather than the present. A potentially life-changing development for sufferers of PTSD, and a reminder that just because something once scared you doesn't mean you have to be frightened forever. Expose yourself. Specific phobias are often treated with exposure therapy, confronting the dreaded object in increasingly intense ways. An arachnophobe might start looking at a picture of a spider, then a spider-stuffed animal, and ultimately engage with a real arachnid. It's very effective. 60 to 90% of patients who stick with the protocol see improvement, but it can be difficult to keep confronting your deepest fear. Karen and a colleague are currently experimenting with flipping the script, starting with the most terrifying but amusing over-the-top version of a fear and scaling down. For example, says Karen, we took a subway car, which is a common exposure for people with social anxiety, and using virtual reality techniques, filled it not only with people but with zombies and other scary but fun figures. Preliminary findings show that starting with the outlandishly worst-case scenario that works its way down to an everyday fear makes that phobia seem, says Kerr, like no big deal. It's new research that bears out an old truth. Fear loses its power once we face it. Our next article by Ariel Schinkel is titled, How to Balance Hormones Naturally. You might not give too much thought to your hormones on a day-to-day basis, but they play an important role in your overall health and well-being, impacting numerous body processes, including your metabolism, mood, sleep and wake cycle, growth and development, sexual functioning, and more. Our bodies are made up of more than 50 different hormones that are created and released by the endocrine system, a body-wide network of glands in charge of regulating your hormones, which serve as the chemical coordinators throughout the body. Think of hormones as chemical messengers responsible for sending signals to different parts of your body through the bloodstream. They travel via your organs, skin, muscles, and other tissues to help control and regulate your body's functioning. Since your hormones are in control of so much, any sort of hormonal imbalance, either temporary, such as periods of high stress, or chronic, such as caused by an autoimmune condition, can throw things seriously out of whack and have you feeling off or not at your best. As with any medical concerns, checking in with your doctor is your best bet, as they can provide a thorough examination, including blood work, to determine if your hormones are to blame. Once your doctor has ruled out any underlying health conditions that could be contributing, there are plenty of easy lifestyle changes you can adopt that will help balance your hormones naturally and set you on the path to feeling like the best version of you. Keep reading to hear some advice from a trio of endocrinologists who told Oprah Daily about the solid habits that will help keep your hormones in check. Eat a balanced diet. There's no shortage of fad diets out there that make all sorts of lofty claims, but when it comes to protecting your health in the short and long term, prioritizing nutrient-dense foods is key to keeping your body nourished and supporting your body's ability to regulate its processes, says Yasmin Akunji, a board-certified endocrinologist with Paloma Health. She recommends eating enough protein and healthy fats with each meal and limiting sugar whenever possible. Some solid protein sources include eggs, many types of fish, and chicken breast, while nutrient-rich fats include olives, nuts, and avocados. Don't skip meals or scarf down your food. When you're constantly on the go, it's easy to realize it's been hours since you last ate and suddenly hunger is setting in. You might then reach for whatever's quickest or easiest in the moment, which might not always be the most satisfying nutritious option, says Erica Lundgren, endocrinologist and assistant professor at the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. In the short term, skipping a meal may increase hunger such that we're more likely to eat convenience foods very rapidly, she says. Quickly consuming or refined foods can allow sugar to hit our bloodstream quicker than our body can keep up and process it, leading to a surge of insulin release that, when it does kick in, can cause a sugar crash or even low blood sugar in some individuals. Prioritize gut health. So much of your hormonal output is regulated in your gut, but many of us have no idea what it means to prioritize gut health. Puranjali Souza, MD, medical director at the District Center for Integrative Medicine and B, a wellness proponent, when working with my patients, I always start with the gut, especially when it comes to unwinding imbalanced hormones. A healthy microbiome and proper elimination are fundamental and directly related to what you feed your body daily. Cutting out a bunch of foods is not necessarily the first right step. Instead, consider incorporating more fiber-rich foods into your diet. Fiber from foods like nuts, seeds, and green veggies provides the fertilizer for your healthy gut bugs and encourages elimination with ease. Nix the nighttime TV sessions and scrolling. Think of how you feel after a night or two spent tossing and turning. Groggy, irritable, unable to concentrate, foggy. Sound familiar? Your body needs enough quality sleep on a regular basis to help heal and repair itself after long days. So if you're spending too much time at night staring at your phone or marathon watching Netflix, no judgment, or simply battling nighttime anxiety, you're likely going to be feeling it during daytime hours. Revital Gorodetsky-Baskin, clinical assistant professor at the Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine, recommends creating a sleep routine that you can stick to, including limiting devices before bed, keeping your room cool and dark, and hitting the sheets around the same time every night. Sleep hygiene can help prepare the body and mind to go to sleep earlier and hopefully initiate sleep more easily. Get regular exercise. Finding time to move each day can be tough, but it's so worth it for your overall well-being. And it doesn't mean you have to spend hours in the gym each day or push yourself through punishing workouts you hate. Multiple hormones are impacted by regular movement, which means your body benefits from a consistent mix of cardio and strength training that impacts everything from your mood, you know, that endorphin rush after a solid sweat session, to your ability to de-stress, a crucial component in your hormone regulation. Spend time in nature. A great way to get moving and enjoy some fresh air? Slip your shoes on and get outside, says Souza. The benefits of spending time outdoors in nature are endless. Decreased blood pressure, improved mood, and greater physical fitness, to name a few, she says. When it comes to our hormones, time spent outdoors can significantly decrease stress hormones like cortisol. Elevated cortisol can drive weight gain, skin disorders, gut imbalances, PMS, autoimmunity, and debilitating perimenopause and menopause symptoms. The simple act of spending time in nature can help combat these conditions. Prioritize stress reduction. Staying cool as a cucumber when life is throwing so much your way isn't easy for anyone, but making time for self-care that involves proven stress busters like exercise, meditation, and getting enough Z's will keep you in tip-top shape no matter what obstacle may come. Small bouts of stress can be motivational, but long-term chronic stress can wreck your health, says Souza. Chronic stress elevates cortisol, which in turn initiates further imbalances in your thyroid and sex hormone production. These imbalances can lead to weight gain, anxiety, insomnia, painful periods, heavy periods, and changes in cycle length. Stress management is therefore critical for hormone health. Yoga, meditation, time in nature with loved ones, dancing, prayer, and journaling are all great ways to unwind. New to meditation? Akunji notes that taking even just 5 or 10 minutes a day to try a guided practice will provide major mind-body benefits. Research shows that daily meditation could assist in reducing stress relating to cortisol hormones, depression, and anxiety. This inherently helps folks increase focus, learning, and memory tasks. Limit your vices. Life is too short to deprive yourself of simple pleasures, such as morning coffee or a glass of wine with pals at happy hour. But being mindful about your vices is a good way to ensure you're not relying on them to get you through the day, which could have long-term implications on your health, says Souza. When we depend on coffee to keep us up in the morning and alcohol to help us wind down at night, we're simply masking symptoms and inadvertently creating more havoc on our systems. The deleterious effects of alcohol impact women far more than men, inhibiting the removal of toxins and excess estrogens that turn around and worsen our hormonal health. Caffeine, when overused, can hamstring sleep. Good sleep is by far the most underrated nutrient for balancing hormones. I recommend cutting off caffeine at 12 p.m., if not altogether, and limiting alcohol to 1 to 2 drinks per week. When in doubt, see your doctor. Of course, you should always check in with your doctor whenever things aren't feeling right in your body, says Ahunji. Sometimes it really is important to see your trusted physician. As an endocrinologist, I look into things like insulin resistance, PCOS, thyroid disease, and metabolic syndrome, which, yes, can be treated with a lot of dietary and exercise changes. But the short of it is, sometimes medicine is needed as well. Anytime you plan on making large changes to your health plan, it's probably a good idea to run it past your doctor as well. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean-Philippe is titled Day of the Dead Facts About the Holiday's History and Vibrant Traditions. Day of the Dead, or Dia de los Muertos, celebrates life, with spirited traditions that largely take place across Mexico, Latin America, and the United States. Family and friends come together to honor their lost loved ones on November 1st and 2nd. Traditions include gathering at cemeteries to enjoy traditional foods like pan de muerto, bread of the dead, and calaveras, sugar skulls, dressing up in eye-catching costumes, and assembling colorful floral decorations, which often include symbolic marigolds. This tradition is rooted in the native Mexican belief that life on earth is a preparation for the next world and of the importance of maintaining a strong relationship with the dead, Juan Aguirre, Executive Director of the Mexican culture nonprofit Mano a Mano, tells Oprah Daily. But what is at the heart of these beloved festivities? Here's a look at the Day of the Dead's rich history and some facts you might not have known about the Mexican holiday. It's not a funeral, it's not morbid, and it's not about being spooky. It's about joy and color and flavor and celebration, all the mixed emotions, James Beard Award-winning chef Patty Jannik adds. It's a very Mexican thing to have extreme sadness with extreme joy at the same time. Here's a look at the Day of the Dead's rich history and some facts you might not have known about the Mexican holiday. Dia de los Muertos is not a somber occasion. During the ancient Mexican holiday, it's believed that spirits of the dead momentarily return to the land of the living for a brief reunion. The community looks at death as an opportunity for renewed life. Day of the Dead is celebrated with parades, festivals, and more across Mexico. Though these traditions are universal, various regions across the country also have their own unique takes on how to honor the dead. Mexico City has held a boisterous parade since 2016, complete with entertainers in bold costume, music and dance, and floats. National Geographic identifies Michoacán as the place to go for foodies. The people of La Huasteca Potosina indulge in day-long parties, while Aguas Calientes Festival of Skulls have near week-long celebrations that include their annual skeleton parade, Legends of Mexico. And at Guanajuato's University of Guanajuato, students create an altar, much loved by photo-snapping tourists, that honors deceased scholars. Dia de los Muertos is not connected to Halloween. While Halloween and Day of the Dead occur nearly in tandem and share similar customs, candy, face painting, and community gathering, the two are not related. Halloween has ancient Celtic roots, while Day of the Dead has its own origins that date back to the indigenous people of Mexico and Central America. The holiday first began with the Aztecs. Roughly 3,000 years ago, amongst the Aztec, Toltec, and Mayans, death and the dead were seen as a natural part of life that should be honored and celebrated rather than mourned. In particular, the Nahua people of central Mexico believed the deceased traveled on a years-long journey to the land of the dead. The living would provide supplies, such as food and water, to aid them on the trek. This practice inspired the modern tradition of creating altars, known as ofrendas, at their homes, in addition to leaving offerings at the gravesites of loved ones. Dia de los Muertos wasn't always celebrated in November. Once the Spanish colonized Mexico in the 16th century, their own Catholic views on the dead influenced Mexican customs. Dia de los Muertos was originally celebrated in the summer months. The holiday came to fall on November 1st and 2nd to align with All Saints' Day and All Souls' Day on the Catholic calendar. The first day honors children who have passed, while the second celebrates adults. Altars, or ofrendas, are the centerpiece of celebrations. To beckon spirits back into the land of the living for the festivities, revelers create makeshift altars, or ofrendas, at their homes, and at the gravesites of their deceased loved ones. Families gather at the site to eat, tell stories, and even clean the graves. Offerings to the dead are inspired by the four elements. Ofrendas are decorated with offerings for the spirits that are meant to represent the four elements of fire, water, earth, and wind. Fire, candles are lit to help guide the spirit's journey. Water, pitchers of water are left to quench their thirst while traveling to the land of the living. Earth, a variety of traditional foods are prepared to help nourish the dead. And wind, papel picado, are vibrant, delicate paper banners that are strung. They're decorated with elaborate cutout patterns that are said to allow souls to pass through. Altars are also adorned with sentimental photographs, toys, marigolds, and skulls. One of the most prominent symbols of the holiday, the signature skull face, originated from a Mexican illustrator. It's likely that even those who don't celebrate Day of the Dead are familiar with the holiday's famous symbol, calaveras, aka the skull. Perhaps you've seen them as decorative face paint, costumes, delicious sugary treats, or even in Pixar's Oscar-winning animated film Coco. But as with everything for Dia de los Muertos, its significance has a rich history. Around 1910, Mexican illustrator José Guadalupe Posada created a satirical lithograph that offered commentary on the political and societal unrest of the time, particularly the elite's tendency to adopt Eurocentric customs. Perhaps you've seen them as decorative face paint, costumes, delicious sugary treats, or even in Pixar's Oscar-winning animated film Coco. But as with everything for Dia de los Muertos, its significance has a rich history. Around 1910, Mexican illustrator José Guadalupe Posada created a satirical lithograph that offered commentary on the political and societal unrest of the time, particularly the elite's tendency to adopt Eurocentric customs. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.